It's Song Talk Radio with Michael, Neil, Phil, and the gang.
Good evening, good day, good morning, and welcome to Song Talk Radio, the show with songwriters talking to other songwriters about the craft of songwriting. Makes sense. We share tips, tools, techniques, and together we all become better at writing songs. That's the theory. And you know, in practice, I think it has proven to be the case as well. I'm your host, Mike Proudfoot, and with me are the members of the Song Talk Radio Action Team, my co-hosts this evening, Phil Emery. How are you, Phil?
I am okay today.
You're just recovering. We'll get to why in
a second.
We'll
get to why in a bit, yes.
Yeah. Neil, how are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's Neil Modi, in case you're new to this.
That's right.
And so during the show,
Respect my authority.
During the show, please feel free to send your comments and questions to @songtalkradio on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or email us at feedback@songtalk.ca. And we will share your emails with our audience. We love getting any kind of comments. I mean, we prefer the positive ones, and we love hearing about the music that you're working on. Lately, a lot of you have been sending us your songs, which is great. Thank you. Please keep doing that. Tonight, we have ourselves, so we'll be talking about what we're up to, what's new in music, and some songwriting tips, as always. But back to poor, sick Phil, but you're sick for a good reason, right?
Yes, well, I managed to get my... my AstraZeneca shot on Monday morning.
The Aztec camera?
The Aztec camera. I wish, because, man, that guy is amazing. Oblivious and still on fire. Great song.
Roddy Frame?
Yes, yes.
That's his name.
And he shreds on an acoustic guitar. When you hear him like play solo stuff, he's an amazing guitarist. It's amazing.
I did not know that.
Anyways, AstraZeneca, unfortunately, it won't deal with us getting distracted, but it does help with the COVID-19 virus. And I got the AstraZeneca yesterday morning at 10, and I didn't feel anything.
Injection site sore? That was when I got the shot. That's what
nothing.
It was.
Really, I couldn't even feel it. I couldn't even feel it in my shoulder, and even when the nurse was going to put the bandage on, she was going, "Where is it?" So I felt fine, and so I got home, and I was like, "Wow, this is perfect." And then I started feeling a little bit rough over the next day, and then by last night, it was like having the full on flu. I had fevers and shaking and chills and headaches and. It's interesting because I haven't gone anywhere, and anytime I've gone anywhere, I've worn a mask. I haven't actually even had a cold, since this whole thing began. Mm-hmm. So I kind of forgot what it was like to be sick, and it's not good. Mm-hmm. So I guess it means that it's working. So
that's exactly
it means you actually did get the shot.
Well, I was a bit worried, actually.
Yeah.
Did they miss?
Well, yeah. And then, so I'm still feeling a bit rough today. I think by tomorrow I should be okay. But,
I'm glad you're on the road to recovery.
Yeah. No, I went to bed very early last night.
Yeah. Nothing like rest.
Yeah. That's a cure all for everything.
Everything.
Even keeps you young, apparently.
That's right.
Yes.
Now, Neil, you were talking that you have, you saying you wanted to talk about a struggle you're having. Was that with the virtual instruments management, or is that something else? Since we're dealing with the conflict on the show right now.
We got struggles all over the place. Where would you like me to start?
Oh, dear.
Let's dive in, Neil.
Let's dive in. Yeah, so.
Are you working on something that's giving you a problem, or what's
Yeah, so my latest project, I may have mentioned on the show, I'm trying to do like a mixture of like electronic and orchestral music, right? And as a way into this project, I contacted a friend of mine, Kira Braun, who sang on a couple of songs of mine. She's a classically trained singer, sings opera. I saw her play the lead in Carmen a few years ago and stuff, and is really, really talented singer. And turns out she's also a poet. And but not a songwriter as such, right? So right. I reached out to her and I said, look, I'm trying to think about this project. Would you be interested in doing the vocals for it? Because it's supposed to be orchestral. And she said, yes. And I said, I would really love it if you shared some of your poetry and I could base the songs on the lyrics off of that. And she said, sure. She has a website with all her poems. A lot of them very emotionally wrought and kind of go to, you know, sort of dark places and stuff like that. So really, really compelling stuff that I thought would be great to make lyrics out of. But the approach that I wanted to take musically ended up being a bit of a conflict with the lyrical approach, only because I wanted to take a very non-structured approach to this and kind of have a meandering musical line through, you know, to make it, you know, however long the song is going to be or whatever. Like, I just didn't want like verse, chorus structure. I wanted to sort of play around with a more abstract structure, but the couple of poems that I tried of hers, they're very structured. And so I can't help going, well, if this is a repeated, you know, verse in the, or sort of chorus type thing in the poem, how do I not repeat the same music for that? Cause that's your inclination is to go, well, there's a structure to the lyric that I'm working with. So how do I break out of that to do it? And if I do it, it's just going to feel forced and it's just going to feel contrived and weird. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around how to do that.
That's a good challenge to have, to try to be freer. Usually people are trying to corral all these strands into something that's coherent and organized and structural, and your problem is the opposite.
I have a feeling the approach that I need is just to sit down with the words and write melodies and very different melodies, and then I can go, and then that's going to give me different structure of different chord patterns, different things underneath it. But I need to go and I need to fight against playing the same melody for the same, you know, couplet line or, you know, that sort of thing. But that's going to be a challenge in and of itself, I think.
I don't know if this will help, but when writing melodies, like trying to come up with a variety of melodies on around the same musical, so like vocal melodies over a musical bed, when I get stuck on the same ones, I try to make it hard to listen to it, meaning I'll, you know, like play it through headphones, but put the headphones like further away. I find barely hearing music in another room or singing along to music I'm hearing for the first time helps come up with vocal line. Like, it just makes it a bit freer. When you have headphones on and you're hearing the music really clearly, it seems to make you follow the road a bit more faithfully. And if you're trying not to, barely hear your music and just try melodies with it that way and like record those melodies on your phone and then stitch them together later, perhaps.
That's an interesting idea. I think I might.
That's a great idea.
That's cool. Yeah. And anything that puts you out of your comfort zone or what you're used to, I think is good.
Yeah, like you've got a thread of it because it's there, so you're not like you, and so you know how long it is and when there are changes, but you don't really have that, you don't really have the melody, the tune so clear to you, so you don't feel self-conscious about going further astray. Anyway, I find that really helpful in writing vocal.
That's knowledge. A great idea.
Very good.
I never thought about it. Another way of looking at it is that I think, especially when you come from a pop song structure background, is you tend to write melodies that are usually 8 bars long. You know, that's usually those sections. So try to write a melody that actually doesn't resolve for 16 bars or 20 bars or something like that. And that will kind of force you, because, you know, we're normally, we go da 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 da. We're sort of used to those kind of very tight formations. Where if you look at the melody as a much longer expression, then that might kind of free you up in a bit, in a few ways.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. And
dare I say, make it 17. Make it odd length. Yes. You know, because then you're not forced to wrap things up and a predictable pattern, especially if you're dealing with something that's a little, you're not as concerned about. structural, consistent structural integrity throughout the whole thing.
I guess there has to be some degree of repetition or else it's just a little too crazy, but.
Bohemian Rhapsody doesn't repeat.
I guess it doesn't.
Simple Math. It's a Manchester Orchestra. Paranoid Android. I mean, there's refrains.
Yeah.
The solo kind of repeats. Yeah. But for the most part, it doesn't.
True.
Okay. It's true. And a lot of drum and bass stuff. I mean, let's think about drum and bass. It actually doesn't repeat at all. That's true. It's electronic style. They have sort of a motif that they work with, but it's constant change all the way through. So,
okay.
I don't even know Freebird just starts slow and keeps going. It has a lot of guitar solo in it, but I don't think it repeats either. Offhand, I could be wrong on that one.
Yeah.
So that's...
There's an idea for a theme show, guys.
What?
Songs that don't repeat.
That's true.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Structure-free songs.
Phil, how's your drums working out?
Well, it's... It's been interesting.
Your cheap electronic drums.
My cheap Alana drums by Donner, by Donner Music. And they seem to be very resistant to, there's a couple of buttons that actually don't work. You press them and nothing happens.
Seems wrong.
And that seems kind of wrong. And I wasn't upset that it happened because you can get, lemons from when you buy Apple stuff. You can, it doesn't mean it's bad quality. I happen to get a bad
you're
one.
You're being too forgiving, I think. But sorry,
but I like to be reasonable, But so they keep on. So I send them an email. They say, "Oh, we'll press this," and the kit button allows you to move between drum kits. And I say, "Yes, I know. It doesn't do anything." And they say, "Well, we have to." And it's just like they keep on sending me back the stuff that was in the manual. And I'm saying, I know that. It doesn't work. These buttons do not work. And I'm not sure why. Like at this point, I'm thinking, just send a new sound unit because the sound unit is useless without all the other stuff. So it's not like you can plug other things into the sound unit, right? I even have the box still that I could send the old one back. But it's been strange, and you have to.
Did you like record yourself on your phone, video pressing the button and nothing happens, and you can show them? Like,
I did, yeah.
Video? You did,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's been very strange.
Customer service leaves something to be desired.
Yeah, and I think if you get a unit that works fine, then it's not an issue. It's just I happen to have a bum unit, and.
And before you bought it, you said it was well reviewed on Amazon or whatever, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're not the greatest ones, but the actual quality of the hardware is surprisingly good.
Yeah.
I mean, for that amount of money, it's definitely worthwhile.
Now, they're aware that you host a podcast about music and will be talking about their shoddy products
Smackdown
every week.
Well,
doesn't seem like good business practice.
Good PR.
No, but I make a point of whenever I'm doing anything in the music industry of not saying that because, for one thing, you don't want to be that "do you know who I am" kind of person.
I'm not suggesting that song talk carries much weight. Just saying, but, it is a microphone of a sort.
That is, yeah.
It was like that Rick Beato is great at the rants. He's got that one video on YouTube. Apple is great if you like crap. Poor Apple, a new one in that video. Was not.
What is he referring to? The entire product line?
The entire thing. I don't. I watched it a while back. I don't remember exactly what he said.
Oh, okay.
Just like hated everything Apple.
Whereas I like to get. I want to make sure that I get the. If I'm going to comment on it, I want to get the experience that an average person, would get.
Yeah, so, and you're being very fair about it. And fortunately, you have a bit more electronic and sort of technical skills too. So you probably figured out exactly what is wrong with it.
Yeah.
You just need to get a hold of these people.
And if they do refuse to fix it, then I will take it apart and see if, I mean, it's all surface mount stuff, so that's a little bit more fidgety to fix. But, sometimes you can I mean, sometimes like the, like there'll be a bad solder joint and it's really, really obvious. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially with some of this cheap stuff, they, you know, they're manufacturing them so fast that sometimes it's just a bad solder joint and you look at it and go, okay, so that might be it. But, so that's my drum update, but it's still, you know, it does make noise when you hit it and it's still kind of fun.
Most things do.
Well, that is true, actually.
Yeah, and that's cool because you actually have some you have some expertise in that area, Phil, with soldering and electronics and
It's fun.
So, and everything, so that's good.
Awesome. Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Neil, you were doing some research for us on a show that we're going to do down the road.
Yeah,
but we didn't quite understand what it was about non. Oh, NFTs,
non-fungible tokens.
And you know a bit more about what the hell those things are? Because we were interested because Sons of Leon released an album that you could buy only through NFTs.
Kings of Leon. Yeah, so it's actually our show, our episode next week. We're bringing back Eric Alper, who we had on the podcast a couple years ago, I think, or last year maybe, before times. And And he's going to be talking a little bit more about NFTs or non-fungible tokens. And I'm subscribed to this website. We actually looked at them before. Oh, where'd it go now? the Discmakers blog. When we did our songwriting do's and don'ts episode a while back, it was the same blog. And they had a little video and a little article about can you sell your music as an NFT? And it was kind of the same thing. He was talking about Kings of Leon, how they did it and everything like that. And the whole the thing that he said in the video that made a little bit more sense to me is that when we talk about like artwork, like there's one original Mona Lisa. And that has value because it's the one original. There's one original Starry Night, and that has value, because et cetera, et cetera.
Right. The rarity is what gives it value.
Yeah. And the fact that it's rare and that it's unique. Now, when it comes to digital assets, they are unique in the sense that someone created it. But if you make copy after copy after copy, ostensibly it's the same quality. It's the same. It's literally a copy that's of the same value, like from a material sense. So what the NFT does is it ascribes a value to the original creation of that thing, whatever it is, right? Uh-huh. So his attitude towards the music thing was that if you are in a band or you're an artist who's really, really popular, then you can probably get away with selling your album as an NFT or selling some other digital asset of yours as an NFT, because you'll have, you know, legions of fans, of which some are, you know, super fans will pay up for that privilege. Because essentially all it is just the ability for me, if I were to buy a digital asset, an NFT, that I could say that I'm the owner of it. And as well, it could be seen as an investment because someone else may want that digital asset ownership for more. It doesn't mean that you have any control over that asset, because whoever created it or whoever distributed it still has control over how it's distributed and where it goes and who has access to it and who can download it and all that sort of stuff. But really, it's just the token part of it, I think, is just the ledger in the blockchain, ledger line.
So it's a digitally verified thing that makes the rarity of it is digitally verified.
Yes.
Or guaranteed or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm a bit closer to understanding it, but not understanding the point yet.
Yeah, no, hopefully when Eric comes on the show next week, he can illuminate some of that. But again, I think the other thing he said in the Discmakers blog was that a lot of the people buying NFTs are people who are already in the cryptocurrency space, so they already made their money on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Or another cryptocurrency, so they feel a little more free maybe to spend that cryptocurrency on an NFT. It's not you know, quote unquote, real money, although they'll probably contest that it is.
Right. Cause they're already fine because they're working in a digital world or virtual world anyway.
Yeah.
I'm one of those old fashioned Luddites who want tangible assets. Yeah.
So it's not like you're selling the rights to your song, because you can sell like a, you know, Bob Dylan sold his catalog.
Yeah, yeah.
So he sold the rights.
Paul Simon recently.
Yeah.
Yes. So he actually sold the rights to their songs, which means if their songs get played or covered, they don't get any more money for it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not, an NFT is not that.
It's not that.
No. So those are totally separate.
I think the non-fungible token, the word token is very telling, because it is, it's a token. It's not, I'm hesitant to say it's not real, because it is, because people are doing it, but it is literally just the statement of ownership.
Right. It's like a certificate of
say sorts, I have this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we'll know much more after talking to Eric next week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll be interesting.
That's our hope.
It's similar to the, I don't know if you guys saw that YouTube about the A440 versus A32.
Oh, right.
The one YouTuber was talking about how the International Standards Organization identified or prescribed A equals 440 as our standard tuning for everything. Mm-hmm. And that's the one we should be using. And he actually showed the webpage where you can go to the International Standards Association and buy that standard for like 37 francs. Or French euros or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And even Ecubs is like, I don't know what that means. If you like, you can buy A equals 440. For like 50 bucks.
You get a tuning fork?
Yeah, I don't know if you get like I don't know what you get for that. But you claim that you own that standard. And it's like, it's kind of cool.
I mean, unless you're just licensing it or something.
No, but I don't think you have the ability to do anything with it. You can't. No, I don't think you have the ability to change it and say, now we should be at...
I'm going to make the standard...
We're going to make it at 456 429. And drive all the singers crazy. So, yeah, this is very like... It's kind of an idea thing. It's not... That's something you can hold in your hand, you know? It's like... It's very elusive that way and kind of abstract in some ways, but yeah.
Well, I would like to put it out there that I am very... open to selling my tokens, fungible or non-fungible.
Or otherwise.
Even your subway tokens.
Subway tokens, shoes, whatever I got. So, you know, I'm very open to selling that for any kind of monetary value. So just write us at feedback@songtalk.ca and I'll sell you whatever I have.
Mm-hmm.
My sense of well-being, my sense of self.
I like the moose painting behind you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
it's one of Heather's students. I have a songwriting thing, actually.
Yes.
Interesting enough. So
this is the proper place for it.
Well, thank you. I normally write fairly short songs, you know, the classic, you know, first chorus, bridge, end. So I was working on a song, and I'm fairly far on, and actually this was a song I played Neil back when we first met way back when. I think it was a song, do you remember when we were going up to Classic Albums Live Super Trip up North Toronto? Mm-hmm. It's one of the songs I played you in the cars. So it's I'm trying to get all these songs actually recorded, so I finally finished off the lyrics, and so I recorded them, and I sent a rough mix to my to Dave Miner and Mike McInnes and a couple of friends of mine, and they said, oh, it's good, but it's a little long. And I went, oh, really? I didn't really kind of notice that, I guess because I've been listening and working on it for so long. But it's a 6-minute song.
Blasphemy.
Well, I know, for me. And now the last bit, the last minute is almost kind of more of a jam, sort of an atmospheric jam. So I don't really kind of count that. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting idea about song length. So there's a thing in Cubase where you have a track, they call it an arranger track. And you can sort of mark songs as this is the chorus, this is the verse, this is the second verse. Yeah. And it's actually very handy when you're mixing and working on the track that you can sort of see visually where you are within the track, so that you know that you're at that you're in the middle of a chorus or, you know, the verse. It's very helpful. But it also allows you to rearrange your song really easily, because you can say, play part A four times, play part B two times, play part A one time, and you can go back and forth. So it's kind of playing around with that, but trying to see if I could make it shorter. And there's not a lot of places where I could make it shorter. So it's an interesting idea if a song is being too long.
Is it repetitive? Is that what they were responding to?
I don't think so. It's kind of two verses, although each verse has two parts to it. It's a mid-tempo song, so it's like 96 BPM, which makes it longer. So it's like two verses, two choruses, and then there are two bridges. And then a third short verses. Yeah.
Blasphemy again.
I know. It's an interesting idea.
Are the bridges different, or are they the same musical
they're
piece?
They're different, because there's actually kind of a narrative line that goes through this in a way that a lot of my stuff doesn't have that narrative line. So this does have a narrative line. So trying to take it off. I'll send it to you guys too and see what you think.
Yeah, I'd be really interested.
I'm curious to hear that. I do find it interesting that it seems like it didn't bother you until those guys pointed out that it may be a little bit long. So that's kind of telling.
But that could just be, you know, everybody thinks their child is beautiful.
Okay. Yeah.
So
I think a lot of songwriters' songs are too long. Like, and that they don't realize because they're still working it out or for whatever reason. But I noticed that at the meetups, that songs are great, but sometimes they just go on a bit. It depends on the genre too.
It does. I mean,
if you're like Southern rock, there's plenty of room for solos and extended bits, or story songs are good long, but a pop song tends to need to be under 4 minutes, 3:30 would be great.
You were talking about the Supertramp classic albums live that we went to when you shared the song with me oh so many years ago.
That was a long time ago.
And the performance we saw that night was classic albums live doing Breakfast in America, which was fantastic. But that album, which is full of like little 3-4 minute, you know, pop gems, the last track on it, Visions, Child of Visions, I think. It's like, it's like 8 minutes long, and it's got like 5 minutes of that is like a really, really amazing piano solo. and it's the same groove. It's not a progressive rock song in the sense of like really drastic changes and orchestral suite type of thing, but it works, and it's a really, really long song. A good chunk of it is piano solo, I think.
Right, that does it. I was listening to the other, Crime of the Century. Haven't listened to that in probably 30 years. Mm. They are a really funky band. Like, the grooves in that are really tight.
Oh, yeah. My
it's
father...
funny because they seem so English and white to be so funky.
My father bought me that album when I was a kid because he said it sounded, because it looked weird. So, and I had never heard of this band
before.
This
looks weird, son. You'll like it.
Well, I'd never heard of the band before, right? Because this is before they had any kind of radio play at all.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of cool being able to go to going to school and saying, this is a band called Supertramp. You wouldn't know them. They're very new.
The first time I heard that album, I was hitchhiking, and I got picked up by a guy driving a Gremlin, which was a flat-backed kind of hatchback thing, and the guy had two like stereo speakers, not car speakers, but actually house speakers, big ones, in the back of his Gremlin. And so he was, oh, you're gonna hear this. And I think the first song is School, and there's a moment where a kid screams and it really kicks in, and it's like, oh my god, it just sounded fantastic.
Wow, were you
the back of a Gremlin can handle really, really tall speakers.
Was that the GMC one?
An AMC.
Ham seed.
There's a pacer as well.
The pacer. That was my friend had a pacer.
Which was like a fishbowl. And there was one other car they had. They had three of them. There was one more that was sort of like their sports car.
Yeah.
But didn't last.
They were very. Where were you hitchhiking to?
Just home. From town, downtown. I lived kind of in a farm community outside of town.
So, I was.
It's all now suburbs, so it doesn't matter.
I was listening to CBC, Randy Bachman's show on the weekend, and
Vinyl Tap. Yeah,
they were playing songs about dances. That was the theme of their show, and
like the Locomotion, or that kind of thing. Okay,
and it was interesting because I was listening to a song, and you know, we at the meetup and even between us, you know, well, people will play a song, we'll go, oh, well, that's really interesting, but your use of the pronoun made it a bit kind of confusing. And, you know, we get very kind of into the details and the fidgety bits. And they played a song by James Brown called Mashed Potato, Potato Popcorn. Mashed potato popcorn. And his basically the lyrics were mashed potato popcorn. That was it. That was a whole song. Now it was an amazing.
But he had
piece
a whole
song
just that was please, right?
Yeah.
Please, please, please. That was it for the lyrics. So
But you know, he did mashed potatoes. Mashed potato popcorn. He did it with such conviction that actually you didn't mind it. So does show that sometimes you don't have to be super finicky with all this stuff as long as it comes across well.
I'm getting the feeling, Phil, that wasn't the vaccine that got you sick, but it was the mashed potatoes and popcorn.
That
can't be good for you. There's no way.
That combination of mashed potatoes and popcorn doesn't sound good for your stomach.
Not good if you're trying to get off of carbs, that's for sure.
No, it's a very carb-heavy song. Neil, do you have any songwriting tips for the for today?
Songwriting tips?
Yeah, that was kind of a nice one from Phil.
Yeah,
I gave one earlier about the.
You kind of put
we could have worked this out ahead of time, but
well, Michael, what have you been
spontaneity?
Yeah, we have what grievances you have these days? I'm all about the grievances.
What
tonight,
grievances? Songwriting wise, I'm actually I've got like three or four bubbling around. Well, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, like a couple that are kind of sketched out. I just want to record, and I've got a couple more I'm in the process of writing. So I'm in a good state that way. And there's something I want to ask you. I was listening to this band. Now, when you think of bands with great harmonies, who do you think of?
Beatles,
Eagles, the Beach Boys, the Eagles.
But
this band, I was listening to them again. They have tons of hits, and I kind of didn't realize how great their harmonies are. The Hollies.
Yes.
Mm.
Go and check out, and even the early stuff, like there's a Carousel and a Bus Stop, and like they just have three-part harmony, and they're really interesting. So I was listening to it with someone who has much better ears than I, and she was going, "Oh, he's doing a ninth, and he's done this, and have really like just incredible harmonies in a way that other like earlier songs of theirs, you go, okay, I can see where they're nicking from the Beatles or the Beach Boys, but soon they get their own sound, and it's just fantastic. So if you're thinking of putting together harmony pieces for your song, do yourself a favor and listen to The Hollies. There's some great tracks. So,
I was also
that's what I've been doing, writing songs and not writing harmonies as good as the Hollies.
We started listening to the Bee Gees again. And, you know, of course, the Bee Gees started, I think the first time they were on Australian television, I think they were like 10 or 12.
I can tell
or
you a lot about the Bee Gees because I just watched a documentary on them.
And they're amazing. Their stuff is so good.
Yeah, they were English and they moved to Australia and they were on a kids show. So they were like when they were 14 or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they were an older brother and two twins. And they were, they were professional musicians from when they were like 14 and 15.
Where can we see this documentary? Is it streaming?
On, I better get a kickback from this. Amazon Prime has tons and tons of music documentaries. Some of them are fantastic. Some of them are really cheap, but you can tell kind of as soon as you get into it, okay, this isn't done well. They have one on Tom Petty. It's by Peter Bogdanovich, who's, you know, like a really well-known film director. It's about 3 hours plus long, and it is fantastic. It's just, aside from being biographical, it also seems to be a lot richer than most music documentaries. The Bee Gees one has a lot of interesting information about them and some really kind of incredible footage, as does the Hollies documentary I watched. But the Bee Gees, and then they bounced around. They had hits and tons, like, you know, every decade since the 60s. And then at one point, I forget what song it was, they discovered their falsetto with that weird kind of flat tone to it. And then that's what they did from then on. And sometimes you listen to it and you kind of go, grown men are singing like that.
When I was a kid, I thought that was a girl. I thought there was a female singer.
That's really high.
It is.
There was a Twisted Sister one on Netflix. It was really surprising.
Was it good or just surprising what was in it?
I'm not the world's biggest Twisted Sister fan, but I was like, this sounds interesting. And it's amazing how, like, it was really about how Dee Snider came in and kind of kicked all their butts and really got them.
Yeah, he was a good
band. And he was like, yeah, we're going to be thrashy, crazy metal guys, but we're going to be good musicians first. Right.
Oh, nice.
And kind of really, really pushed them in that direction. And yeah.
Yeah. And also then visually, I mean, he was very savvy about how to market them. You know, he made them into cartoons.
Yeah.
But that was the era of music videos. And they were huge a lot of the time because of their really popular cartoony music videos.
Mm-hmm. Interesting how they worked better on video than a band like Kiss, who I don't think Kiss ever was very comfortable on video. They never made sense. But Twisted Sister seemed to be more
designed. They had a whole movie. Didn't they make a movie?
Oh, they did.
Are you getting sick again, Phil?
Even as a kid, I remember going, ooh. Oh, I don't know, guys.
Oh, boy. The Kiss movie?
Michael, I wanted to ask you because most of our listeners don't realize that you actually are a film guy. You're a film director, and you've done lots of different kinds of films, like documentaries.
A lot of documentaries and a couple of dramas and some plays and things like that.
Does that ruin watching films for you?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Does knowing how the sausage is made? No, because it gives you more things to appreciate. I mean, does it knowing about songwriting, being a trained musician, does that spoil listening to music?
It can.
I think. Sometimes it can,
Well, I used to, when I used to go see bands, no one wanted to go see bands with me because I'd be going, the bass player's not very good, and the drum's not, you know, doing all that stuff.
Yeah, I kind of do that too, and it spoils it for me in that sense,
Yeah, so when you, I guess the idea with great art is you lose the knowledge of the creation process and just get lost in the moment. But,
exactly. It transcends the craft and becomes the art.
I can't talk to the wife about music because it's like I'm sitting there analyzing everything and being lyrics this and melody that and why are they like the beats boring and whatever. And she's like, I can sing along to it.
I like melody, I like production. Yeah. I'm not terribly picky about, you know, precision and technique and things that trained musicians are. I have a friend who, you know, is a good musician, and a lot of our friends in common are Toronto jazz musicians. And he and I occasionally find a bridge, but, you know, he was listening, you know, he listens to songs that have proficiency in them. I listen to songs that have passion and noise. And sometimes we meet. I'm fortunate with music. But I don't find that with movies either. I mean, some movies, all you can see is the structure of it and how badly it's done or how badly the acting. But I think that's the deal. If you can see someone acting, then it's not good acting.
Yeah.
If you don't notice the acting, then it's
If it's too contrived. That's the same thing with songs. I mean, because if you get
swept, you like it, great.
Yeah, if you actually get swept up in the emotion of it, then you forget that you're a filmmaker, that you're a songwriter, and you just appreciate it for what it is, right? And that's always a good feeling.
Yeah, exactly. But I've always done music as a kind of parallel, but it's been my hobby, whereas making visual work has been paying my bills.
Yeah. Very
and
cool.
Then there's a, you know, there's a connection too with that, because, you know, you're making, you know, you commission music for the song, for the movies or for the whatever you're doing, which is another interesting part. I remember doing a short, and when we got the score back, it was like you could see it more clearly because it would underline moments. Like, you know, there'd be a moment where a character receives information but doesn't do it in any broad way. He just, like, you know, his eyes just kind of narrow a bit or whatever, which without music you might miss. But then the score just underlined it a bit, like the music tone changed from being kind of a major key to introducing the minor version of it at that moment, and it just clearly helped you understand what was going on in that character's head. I just found that process to be fascinating. You weren't necessarily aware of the music, but it did make the pictures and the intent sharper.
That's when it's done well, too. I was watching, Heather and I were watching Elizabeth on Netflix, I think, last on Saturday.
Is that with Cate Blanchett?
Cate Blanchett one?
I think so, yeah.
Or is that?
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the music for that was just so overblown and just, it's terrible because it just, it overpowers it overpowers the visuals, and it just, it becomes relentless. And it's like,
I haven't seen that movie for a long time, but I remember that movie. I remember the tone of that movie was very, it was all about richness and lush.
Yes.
It was just like, yeah. Brimming.
I think it was done by an
stuff.
Indian director, right? Who had done some other, like he'd done.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
I forget his name, but yeah.
But yeah, that's like, I hate it when you start paying attention to the music and you go, wow, this is really obnoxious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had movies ruined because of the music. Either music is bad or just too much. Even John Williams, who, you know, Spielberg is a big fan of, is a bit much.
Well, it's because it's a John Williams. You go see a John Williams movie. You know, that's kind of the shtick.
Guess, yeah.
That's kind of the deal. Yeah.
Yeah, like you would want to hear him do like a nice little soft folky thing. I mean, that's not why you go to see John Williams, you know? You want the big bombastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually was watching a documentary series just because of the quality of the music. I think on Korean, but I just love the music. It was sad, and it was just a masterful portrayal of this wonderful, it sounded new, but it wasn't overblown. It was a great piece of music. I wish I could figure out what the series was so I can listen to the music again.
Sometimes that, it's the opposite. You do notice the music, but in a positive way. You know, you just go, that worked really well, or you got caught up in it. I watched Black Hawk Down, and there was a part of the film scored to this, he died a little while, Tahar, I think his name is. He's an Algerian musician. And it was almost like this heavy metal kind of, but all in Arabic tones. And it was just great. So I went out and bought his album because I just loved that song so much. Mm-hmm. And it didn't distract me from the movie. It just felt very good in the movie, but I just, I love that.
If anything, that's my songwriting tip, is investigate the nuances of the emotions behind music and behind chord choices. A lot of singer-songwriters put a lot of their weight for the emotions in the lyrics, but like you're saying, Mike, like that pivot in the character's point of view or whatever they're experiencing, and it's just underscored by, you know, a certain kind of musical shift. That's really, it's a really, really powerful thing. And it often gets overlooked, or there's missed opportunities for that in a lot of songs, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like you write the song in a G and a C and a D, use a capo, move it up, try it in a different tone and see if, because just moving it up, like the same chords arrangement, progression, will sound markedly different as you transpose it.
Yeah. Or non-diatonic.
That's true.
I don't know what you mean.
So diatonic, you may have to clarify this for me, Phil, if I get it wrong. Diatonic is like all the white keys, like that's all like going up and down the major scale, right? And all your chord choices are there. But as soon as you start putting in what they call accidentals, notes that don't belong in the scale, that's when things start getting interesting. And you start borrowing from other keys.
I was talking about writing on a guitar, but is that sort of the same thing as you go up, even if you keep the same chord shapes, if you go up the neck, you're going to find some accidents?
You might find a different tone.
It will change things in ways.
But if you play the same, chords and the same shapes, just capo up, you're still playing the same progression, ostensibly. It's just in a different key. So, but the magic comes in the relative relationships within that.
Because each key sounds different.
Each key does sound different, but if you're playing a 1-4-5 in C and then you play a 1-4-5 in F, it's still a 1-4-5.
It's still 1-4-5, but they do sound different.
They do sound different, but what I'm arguing for is going away from those standard. You know, the 1-4-5
puts
you through all the major scale notes.
Yeah.
You know, but try, like you say, borrowing the minor from another key, borrowing something from a different key, that sort of thing can, in terms of the emotional quality of the song and emotional quality of the music. I find, you know, artists like bands like Crowded House, for example, they always have these like magical moments where there's a definite chord change and you know it's something that's out of the key or something like that, and it's just like this amazing drop or amazing kind of thing, and it extends what the lyric does and what the melody does and everything like that. Like, it's, you know, it can be a powerful thing.
Very much so. In the news, I don't know if you guys got this. So the Simpsons on the weekend did an episode, Panic in Springfield, I think that's the title. Anyway, there was a character based on Morrissey and the Smiths.
Oh, really?
And now Morrissey, the person, has said some pretty borderline racist things, and he's curmudgeonly guy. He's very and when you go back to some of the lyrics, they weren't that nice anyway. So the Simpsons portray the end of career Morrissey as a fat, a rude meat eater, because he said it's the foreigners brought vegetarianism to Earth or something like that. Anyway, so I saw a little clip of it. It looked very funny. But Morrissey has responded by saying how unfair that was to portray him thusly as a curmudgeonly bigoted person, which, you know, is kind of what he is. So yeah, a lot of the newspapers, and especially the music magazines, are having fun with him today with that.
It's like, can you say satire? Like,
laugh at yourself.
Exactly. Supposed to be unfair.
You have been, like, the whole episode is based on you, my man. Be flattered.
Yeah, laugh at yourself. Too, right? It saves God the trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
It's just faster.
Yeah, it's
And that's it in music news today, and that and Jim Steinman, the producer and I think writer of Bat Out of Hell, one of the biggest albums of its time.
That's right.
Passed away.
And an album my friends used to play all the time that I hated with a fiery passion.
People either loved it or hated it. I got the impression more people hated it, but it was on the radio.
Oh, people loved it.
Huge hits for a long time.
Anything for love.
I remember when I was working at Much Music and Meatloaf came in and, it was a fun place to work, but I was working overnight and I had a job to do, and they pushed all the desks out of the way so he could perform, and I couldn't get at the music library because all the desks were in the way. So at that time I was not happy with Meatloaf. So.
Meatball was that's what it was. That's it. We just started out. It was just Meatball.
He was just Meatball. Then he used to be partnered with Spaghetti, but they broke up.
He was in Fight Club. He was really good in
he's
been in other movies too.
He's a very talented guy. I just didn't like the songs.
Yeah, it's very over the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And but I think that was it. I mean, like it stood out. And talk about, oh, and to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, long songs. These are pop songs, and they were like 5 and 6 minutes long.
That's true.
They were epic.
Maybe I'm doing my own Bat Out of Hell.
That's what you're doing.
But I think I hear
the band.
I think you're right. I think that is all the time we have tonight on Song Talk Radio. So thank you, everyone, for joining us as we followed a long and winding road through the show today. Mm-hmm. Send us your impressions of the show or whatever's on your mind to us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Send it to @SongTalkRadio or send us an email to feedback@songtalk.ca. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel for live performance videos and full episodes. And so that's right. So that's at songtalk.ca. And subscribe to the Song Talk Radio podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher.com, Spotify, or Podcast Addict, or wherever the hell you get your podcasts. And you can sign up for a free newsletter on songtalk.ca. And that's where you'll also find all the books and products and web services and tangents that we go on that will be featured also on the website at songtalk.ca. Coming up soon, we have another Song Talk meetup, and you can find out about where and when that is. Well, it's where is virtual. It's on the internet. But how you join us, you can find out by going to meetup.com or by going to songtalk.ca. So that's, I think we've made our point. Where we want you to go to is the website, songtalk.ca. And if you don't want to go there, but you still want to find out about Neil, where would they find more about you?
NeilMody.com.
NeilMody.com. And Phil,
on which I have a link to songtalk.ca.
And Phil, how about
back
you?
Road.
PhilEmery.ca.
Excellent. So when you get all these songs finally produced, that might be a way to find them. As for me, you can see some pretty pictures on Instagram. That's Proudfoot420. That's it. That's all I'm allowing at the moment. Did we mention dropping by the website at songtalk.ca? I can't remember. You can browse past shows there, too, and you can see how you could be a guest. Thank you, everyone, for sending your music into us, and we'll see you again soon. Keep on writing. Good night.